Technology is reversing the devastating effects of cocoa farming on the forestry of Ghana.
Scottish research is helping find an effective treatment for Parkinson's disease.
Think business, then think low taxes. Think lower living costs, but think higher quality of life. Think well connected, think making connections. Think transforming and disrupting industries. Think breaking the mold. Think you need a break? Ha! Think being surrounded by all this. The most beautiful country in the world. Think about getting away from it all, just a few hours' drive away. Think health. Think healthcare. Think healthy lifestyle. Think style and substance. Think new experiences day in, day out. Think education. Think talent. Think access to the most educated workforce in Europe, including four of the world's top universities. Think potential. Think reaching it. Think surpassing it. Think using our thinking to change the world. Not waiting for someone else to step up, but leading the way and changing the game. Think having the nerve to scrap ideas and go again until it's better. Then better again, and again, and again. Think of a country hungry for the next challenge, next problem, next opportunity, and ready to take on the impossible. Now, think of your business, your future, your opportunities. Think of what Scotland could do for you. So, what do you think of Scotland now? Think different, think Scotland. Scotland is now.
Think you know Scotland? Think again. Think one of Europe's biggest life science clusters. Think the data capital of Europe. Think real-time patient data and access to the data you need to develop things faster. Think academia and first-class talent. Think Scotland being home to four of the UK's top five universities for medicine. Think leading the way in academic research and a global reputation. Think world-leading and a country pushing boundaries of what's possible.
Scotland is leading the way in pancreatic cancer research, developing a new breakthrough approach for treatment. A world-first dental imaging system allowing dentists to identify and prevent tooth decay in patients.
Think an internationally renowned clinical trial infrastructure and an integrated healthcare environment. Think precision medicine, then think bringing together world-class clinical research, data, patient samples and gene sequencing. Think gene therapy helping cure major genetic diseases. Think an ambition to cure Alzheimer's disease. Think innovation, expertise and pioneering technologies enhancing well-being around the world. Then think our clever bodies joining the fight to develop antibody tests for COVID-19. Think of a country with manufacturing heritage and a comprehensive pharma services supply chain. Think investment. Think mountains of opportunity and mountains to take your breath away. Think a better quality of life for all. Now, how do you feel about being part of it? Think different. Think Scotland. Scotland is now.
Think time is on our side? Think again. Think change, then think ingenuity. Think of a country rethinking the future and striving to create a fairer net zero economy which works for all. Think world firsts.
Scotland is home to the world's first floating wind farm. Floating wind has the potential to power 12 million homes across Europe by the year 2030.
Think the world's first country producing hydrogen from wave and tidal power and building the world's first 100% hydrogen gas network providing decarbonised heat to homes. Think carbon capture and storage. Think more sustainable farming resulting in less methane production. We are pioneering and innovating net zero technologies. Think ambition and a mission to transform how entire cities operate. Think opportunities and communities of innovative thinkers working together. Think full speed ahead for a sustainable transport network. Think electric and hydrogen buses driving us towards a brighter future. Think the world's first diesel electric hybrid vehicle ferries and fully electric fire engines. Think having the appetite for real change. Then think vertical farming. Think satellites detecting wildfires, mapping topography, and preventing deforestation.
Now is the time for businesses to think
green investment and green innovation. Think of a country making history whilst reshaping the future, a sustainable future that benefits all. So think change, think collaboration, then think of your business being part of it, delivering a net zero future. Think different, think Scotland. Scotland is now.
All right, welcome back. And we've got a great session lined up here. As we all know a little too well, COVID-19 really did interrupt supply chains, and we're still having issues today. I was watching CNBC this morning, and you know, they're still trying to decide what portion of inflation we can attribute to supply chain difficulties and what we can attribute to stimulus. And it's very debatable still at this point. So it is my pleasure to welcome our friend Renee Buck to the stage. Renee Buck is president and CEO of BCI Global, a company he founded in April of 1985. So more than 36 years later, BCI Global is one of the world's leading independent manufacturing footprint optimization, location strategy, site selection, and supply chain network design consulting companies in the world. In March of 2022, for the fourth year in a row, BCI Global was recognized by Forbes magazine as one of America's best management consulting firms, the only dedicated location strategy firm on that list. BCI Global has experienced team offices in Europe, I'm sorry, Renee, that is Nijmegen and The Hague, Frankfurt and London, in the US and Atlanta, Los Angeles and the Bay Area, and in Asia, Singapore and Shanghai. Renee Buck.
Thank you, Charles. And can I invite the panelists already to come on stage as well? Take the middle seat.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your attention in this last session of this day. Charles already mentioned, we talk a lot about supply chain disruptions. And for many companies, that started actually already in 2016 when American President Trump imposed import tariffs for products coming from China to the US, which meant for a lot of companies they had to look into, hey, our supply chain is now becoming 25% more expensive. What are we going to do? Then obviously we had COVID-19, but if you think about it, we had also that ship Evergreen blocking for 3 weeks the Suez Canal. We have chip shortages, we have raw material shortages. We have labor market shortages, we have issues with COVID-19, obviously, as a point which everybody touches. So it looks like that if you see that in a row, that supply chain disruptions are not an incident anymore. It's not enough, good enough anymore to have a fire brigade or a business continuity plan within your company. You really have to look into how are you coping with this flow of supply chain disruptions, and what are the answers of companies? And that's why we have today here a fantastic panel to take a closer look at. So I start with Poonam Gupta, CEO of PG Paper. Tell us a little bit about your company.
So we are a global paper trading company based in west of Scotland. We trade in about 60 countries, and we have offices in 8 countries.
And you are a little bit too humble on yourself, because, and I'm just reading here, because Poonam has really an interesting career. She has led the successful Scottish Chamber Task Force to India, has been recognized as one of the 100 most influential in UK-India relations, and a couple of years ago even mentions Entrepreneur of the Year. So this is not just a CEO, this is a class CEO. All right. Then we go to the second panelist, to John Lusk. John, tell us a little bit about the company you represent. You are a Senior Vice President and COO of Maritime Spire Global.
Yeah, so
what is this company doing? What are you doing for a living?
We do a lot. So Spire Global is a space-based data analytics and space-as-a-services company. We build, design, and manufacture small satellites about the size of a bottle of wine. We launch them into space, and we collect data across a number of unique data sets, including the maritime industry, aviation, so ships and planes, as well as weather data that we collect from radio frequencies. We then take that data, do all sorts of fun stuff with it, machine learning, AI, and then sell that data to the companies who then can utilize that data to really maximize operational efficiencies, develop predictive models, and really take a unique perspective from Earth that you typically don't get. Our constellation is 100-plus satellites. It allows us to really go to all points of the Earth, which historically you have not been able to do.
So it's Earth observing data, then you have 100 satellites in space, and how many ground stations to pick up the data?
We have, I believe at this point, 32 ground stations across the globe. You need ground stations in many different parts of the Earth to be able to collect that data and download that data. And we have, I believe, around 70 different antennas across our satellites as well.
And which are the main clients? So let's say, who are your company's clients who want to do something with the data gathered from Earth observing?
Primarily, we're selling into the, the logistics and supply chain. We're also selling into shipping companies, aviation companies. There's a lot of companies out there right now, obviously, with the advent of data. We're still, in my mind, in the very nascent stages of data and data transformation. You hear about digitalization, digital transformation. But we sell to a lot of companies that we call analytics service providers. And what they do is they take our data, combine it, infuse it with all kinds of other different data sets, and then develop their own solutions for very specific segments in different industries. We also sell to government agencies. Particularly, we sell our weather data and our weather forecasts into a number of different agencies, including ECMWF in Europe, as well as NOAA in the U.S.
All right, then, on our right-hand side is Alfonso Alves, Deputy Managing Director of Cellnex Telecom. Alfonso, Cellnex Telecom, what is that company doing?
I will explain it quickly. I'm Deputy CEO of Cellnex UK, not Cellnex Group. We are a Spanish group. We are now working in up to 12 European countries, so Spain, Portugal, Ireland, UK, France. I always forget all the countries. And what do? We are what you could call a tower co. So our infrastructure, mainly passive, is comprised of towers, rooftops on the buildings, fiber optics in some opportunities. So we are providing the infrastructure that the mobile operators normally use for their networks, providing the service to their consumers, to their users. We are also involved in different sorts of special projects for increasing coverage. And in those projects, we do more than the pure passive infrastructure. So we are also involved in the active equipment, in the electronics. Some examples: we are the company providing for the MNOs the coverage here in the UK at the Etihad Stadium in Manchester, San Siro in Milan, Juventus, Atletico Madrid in Madrid, underground in Milan, underground in Madrid. We were awarded during the pandemic here in the UK by Network Rail with the concession for Brighton Main Line. So that means three big stations, London Bridge, London Victoria, Clapham Junction, all the tunnels and the towers to be built for, I mean, an end-to-end connectivity. We are very active with railway in all Europe. So that sort of company, which is not very well known by the user of telephony, because normally our customers are the mobile operators or public administrations, that sort of things.
And what makes your company competitive in the market? Because it's a competitive market you're working in.
Well, it's all about volume. So normally, when we enter a new country, this is based on the need by the mobile operators to monetize the infrastructure. I mean, telecom operators suffer a lot. They are still not amortizing the previous investment for the 3G or 4G, and they need to go for the 5G. New frequency, more sites to be developed, more antennas, more everything. So this is a trend which started in the U.S. with American Tower, SBA, these giant companies. The operators understand sooner or later that having the infrastructure is not making a difference for them. They compete in providing services to their users, not in managing the infrastructure. So they monetize the assets, and that opens the door to companies like us for managing the infrastructure, being acquired in a neutral way. So our towers, after acquisition, are open to all the operators in that country, and not only to the mobile operators, also to other companies needing satellite ground stations to be hosted, or data centers. Or, I mean, we are providing hosting telecom needs, normally for the mobile operators, but also for other customers. What makes the difference? Well, you need a strong financial capability.
You're a stock-listed company,
it's
right?
It's all about capability to invest. Example, we are now in our all 12 countries in the middle of the 5G peak. We are and supporting all our customers in the transition and the deployment of the 5G base stations, creating more sites, building more sites, more rooftops, more towers, more everything. So financial capability. It's very important to keep neutrality. So in your shareholding and in your way of doing things, operators rely on you because you are not competing with them. Okay, that's very important. And I would say a very good relationship with landlords. You cannot have a tower if you don't have happy landlords renting their rooftops, terraces, lands, etc. And public administrations, because you need them to approve the construction project, the frequency allocation, etc. So it's all about, let's say, having the right balance amongst the different interests affecting the business.
Well, these were your 4 minutes of fame for the company, right? If you extend on that, you have to pay the drinks tonight. So
perfect.
Just for you to know. And I know that we are pleased that you are here, because I know that you have to take off immediately after the session back to London. So great to have you here. Our last panelist is sitting here next to me, Koen Gijpers, managing consultant for IBM, and then a specific group within IBM, because IBM is a huge firm, as we all know. Plant Location International, what are you doing on a day-to-day basis?
Hello, Rene. Yeah, so I'm part of the Plant Location International team within IBM. And actually, that team, it used to be an independent company existing for more than 60 years now. And we help companies with their location strategies, supply chain strategies, so helping them with where to locate, where to invest globally. So we do that on a global level. And based on that experience, based on those insights, we also help governments, so IPAs, EDOs, with their inward investment attraction and with improving their competitiveness.
All right. Poonam, I start with you. And you saw already how this goes, right? You did your introduction in 1 minute, and then and then the male panelists all take 6 minutes. So I'll give you the floor first. Now, if you look to your business, PG Paper, I mentioned in my introduction a row of disruptions which happened in the last years. Which one has caused you the most headache?
Well, COVID-19. We've seen 2008, 2009 recession. But COVID-19, and it's still not over, actually. The disruption it's caused is, I believe it's, and most of the industry experts say, we're still looking for a period of another year and a half ahead. So for any business, or even on personal level, you know, 3.5 years of disruption and uncertainty is very, very dangerous. And I think, you know, it would be fair to say it is COVID-19, which is the hardest period my business has seen. Over the years, we have, like any other business, we've faced a lot of, I'm going to try and make my 6 minutes here, just telling you. So, but I'm going to try and make them a little bit interesting as well, do my best. We operate in 60 countries. So when I looked at my business pre-COVID, and we are actually present in Japan, in China, so we have an office in Shanghai. So we had been monitoring COVID practically when the first news came out, because we have eyes and ears on the ground, and we were asking what's going on. We could see the panic in Japan almost immediately, South Korea. And it became kind of obvious that sooner or later, this is coming home too. You know, these lockdowns, one country after the other, they're dealing with something here. The panic, sheer panic at the government level, forget about the public level, you know, said that there is something bigger at play here that none of you, us will understand, and none of this will go away anytime soon. I thought, having worked for 19 years, having struggled with so many issues in so many different countries, that I had built a very resilient business. But COVID truly tested everything. In the past, if one country is not doing well, you know, we have an option. We do more in the other, and we keep the business growing and moving. With COVID, multiple countries came in lockdown, almost like one after the other, one after the other.
But was the problem on the supply side or on the demand side, or on both?
In the beginning of COVID, I think demand, we saw more happening in the UK, at least, because, you know all about the toilet paper. I don't know. I still don't understand what happened, you know, but this whole thing about the toilet paper, there was panic about food, like basic food. But it was more from supply chain side, because our business runs on ships. We export and import, and our major logistics carrier are various shipping lines. And when there are multiple countries shutting down, the ports are shutting down. I mean, I assume that the ships are waiting 10, 15, 20 days to even berth at the port, which means if you then, you know, try look at the supply chain is not 1, 2, 3, 4, it's a whole cycle. So once it starts from one point, it's like a domino effect. And that domino effect disrupted the supply chain completely. And when there isn't, maybe that was the panic which triggered the toilet paper or the food, that, you know, how are things going to come home? And we import so much. Britain depends so heavily on imports in a lot of products, consumer products. And I think that's where we saw, you know, the disruption first, I would say, we felt, started from the supply chain side. There are no people to manufacture. Factories are shutting down. Cities are shutting down. Countries are shutting down. So, of course, that's going to basically come through in the end. Who's the end user is the consumer. So, ultimately, the supply is going to fall on demand as well. Have I done well using my time?
No, more than that. I like your comments. And I will come back to you on how now these disruptions have also changed the strategy of PG Paper. But let's first go to Alfonso. When I mentioned these various disruptions, which are the ones which hurts your company the most, or which are the ones causing the most headache?
Well, actually, three main things, and two of them are related. The first one is about supply chain, and it's about steel. The cost of steel has grown at 200%, more than that. It's the new toilet paper in the pandemic, due to other reasons, due to the mills in Europe stopping during the pandemic, other mills around the world with different contracts with Chinese companies, etc. Logistics, very complicated today. A bit of exacerbation of the problem because some companies stocked material, and that contributed to increasing the price. So it's been really expensive to have steel today at the prices, at the costs you had in your previous contracts with your customers. Huh?
Okay, steel is one. Two.
Second, chipsets, and that's affecting, for example, in the UK a lot, depending on the country. With there was a question in the previous panel about Huawei ban. This is affecting us a lot. You can imagine we were deploying 5G here in the UK for our customers, BT, Hutchison, etc., with a program on their side about their suppliers of equipment, and suddenly, on top of the 5G, we need to reinstall 4G and changing, swapping from Huawei to Nokia. That's a second big problem. Third, Brexit. This is affecting us a lot. Why? In the 4G, 5G peaks, the installation of equipment is massive in 2-3 years. So traditionally, the UK imported riggers, people climbing to the towers and installing the antennas, etc., from Romania, from Poland, from all Europe. This is not happening now. It's more expensive. They have to pay visas. There is a concern in all these countries about how expensive it is now to move resources to the UK. And as we are in all countries installing the same, they prefer to move resources to these countries. So,
but I'm surprised in your list of three that you don't mention the shortage of semiconductors, of chips, because I could imagine that that's so crucial.
It was my second point. It's affecting our
country. Your 3 points were only your second point.
Yes.
Okay.
Chipsets is affecting.
Is that the way how you calculate in your
equipment
company? All right, I'm joking.
When for example, Nokia starting to approach their contracts for the coming 5 years, 3 years ago, they were not, or Ericsson, they were not expecting to increase the number of sites to be deployed in all European countries or around the globe, because Huawei was there. Now Huawei disappears from the equation, so they are happy, they have more orders, but they don't have the capability to install. So at the end, that affects us because we are programming the installation, strengthening of the tower or building of a new tower, and when it's ready, installation of the equipment, we need to plan everything, and maybe the equipment is not there. So it's connected.
If I may go to you, John, I could imagine you are the winner of disruptions, right? Because if we talk about Earth observing data, and we have, and we know all these pictures of those ships waiting for Long Beach in LA. I think everybody has seen those pictures a couple of days ago on all these ships waiting for Shanghai. Who have seen them, raise your hands. You have all seen them. And because there are so much disruption, John is earning money. Tell us. How are you doing that?
Sadly, I feel like the winner during the COVID disruption. We, as an Earth observation company, a lot of companies, ports, shipping companies, they only could turn to data to try to figure out what was going on. And we saw a big increase in sales, tripling our revenue over the course of 3 years during COVID. And we'll just use the ports as an example. We found port operators really looking at ETAs, estimated time and arrivals, which was really, really important to understand, okay, when is this particular vessel actually going to show up?
Yeah.
Historically, ETAs, and they're out there, there's all sorts of companies that deliver predictions on ETAs. Historically, they're off by about 40 to 60 hours. So imagine this, 40 to 60 hours, you've got everything lined up in port, everything from your workers to trucks to trains, all waiting in port or just outside of port for that vessel to come in because of a bad ETA. So we found, port operators really looking more for better predictions. And our real-time data combined with our 10 years of historical data really allowed companies to dig a lot deeper into those data sets and come up with more accurate predictions. One of the things that we haven't mentioned here, but a big loser in all of this was sustainability, right? If you imagine all these log jams in the ports as well, with ships idling out at sea, which burns a lot of CO2, with trucks sitting outside of the ports, with trains sitting outside of the ports, you had a massive impact on sustainability. In fact, I believe there's a study done in both Singapore and the port of Long Beach, where they, during, I think, June of 2020, July 2021, now there was 100% increase in CO2 emissions. Right? And imagine what that does to urban centers in terms of pollution. So we found companies from port companies to shipping companies really starting to use our data. We have weather predictions, weather forecasts, so they can get a better sense of when different ships might be running into specific weather patterns.
I can imagine that if you talk about natural disasters or weather conditions. But the way how you gather data, can you then also say, the problems in the port of Shanghai will be over in 2 weeks, or in Long Beach, we will go back to, on the supply chain disruption has something about planning and scheduling, and on the other side, it's cost. But I think it's so difficult to predict. So you can use your data, but what is the value of it?
I think the value of our data, it is difficult to predict, but that's what we were trying to get to, right? I think the focus right now is more on the last mile. Our argument is if you focus more on the first mile, you start to get a better sense of how you can manage.
Yeah, but if you have a ship crossing the ocean for a large number of weeks, you can monitor that, and then perhaps a storm causes a delay. But then you come to the port, and if you have to wait then there for 2 weeks, then...
Well, that's the idea, is if you know that there's a storm, so if you have severe storms in front of you, you can see that in a particular part of the ocean, which is very remote, which is what our data can see, then you might be able to either reroute that particular vessel or slow it down, right? And if you want to slow it down, there's no point in getting a vessel early to port if it's going to have to wait, right? You're burning CO2, you're costing money, you're actually burning more fuel. So you can slow that vessel down. Right? Instead of it, having an ETA of 6 weeks, you might as well slow it down to be 8 weeks because it's going to sit there and wait anyway. So you can start to manage the supply chain much better. Because again, this is it's. I think someone had said it earlier. There's a lot of different pieces that go into the supply chain.
Let's ask on Kun, in which industries, let's say, if you see all these disruptions, which industries are so impacted by these disruptions that you expect a change in the way how they set up their manufacturing footprint in Europe or around the globe? Which industries are impacted most, according to your experiences within PLI?
Yeah, well, that's a difficult question because basically what...
Yeah, that's why you are a consultant, right? If it would be easy questions, we would be sitting there. Here you are for the difficult questions.
We'd say, so basically what we try to do is indeed to take a step back and see, okay, how do these different trends, these events impact industries in a differentiated way. And indeed, you can see some differences, of course. What we've seen, for instance, through the COVID crisis is what we've seen is that for some industries, resiliency and being able to keep up the supply is very important, like, for instance, for pharmaceuticals, for food. Those are certainly industries where you can expect that also in the future you could see more investment closer to the market because people find this very important. What has also grown now and recently is indeed a strategic interest in having industries closer to markets, like in electronic chip production, for instance. So these are certainly industries where we would expect that. And then in addition, there are also, of course, industries where some of the other trends have a big impact, so mainly technology trends, so which could potentially lead to higher levels of automation, for instance, where you can also expect that it is indeed that the labor component becomes a bit less important. And also there, of course, you get opportunities to move closer to end-user markets.
So the more automated or robotized the operations are, yes, the larger the chance are that they can go to relatively high-cost countries. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but that's indeed a very important point, because often people make the direct link that it would then indeed lead to nearshoring or onshoring. But that's not always the case. It's one possible outcome. But it's not because the labor component is smaller that it by definition would come again to, let's say, very developed industrialized economies. It can still lead to, for instance, nearshoring. For instance, for Europe, there is still a lot of potential, for instance, Northern Africa, which offer a nearshoring potential at low cost, with low labor cost. So the outcomes are not guaranteed, let's say, or not certain in that way.
Poonam, you talked about the impact of COVID, first on the supply, later on also on demand. Has it changed the strategy of your company, of PG Paper? Are you saying now, hey, we need a different strategy, we have to set up our production operations or distribution operations in a different way?
Well, when you're faced with any challenge and you know things are not going to plan, you've got to change the plan. That's the only way to survive or to grow. So when this whole COVID situation saw logistics, a shortage of materials, people, lots of factors, I guess, you know, which came into play, we had to look at, we were preparing in the beginning, we were preparing for about a 40% revenue loss. We were also, because, you know, strategy comes with time, although we are a small team, which means we are quite dynamic, so we could make business decisions pretty fast, try and understand what's happening, consumer mindset. And what we did was the shipping industry kind of hit us the hardest. Mm-hmm. Because, like I said, logistics is a big portion of our costs. And not just that, we are dependent upon the shipping industry to move our products around the world, whether they're going from Peru to China, China to America, whatever that segment is. What we started doing is that we started looking at where is mainly our supplies come from. I mean, our supplies come from around 18 countries.
Okay.
But it was some countries were tougher than the other. So yes, there was a complete overhaul of the strategy in terms of where we are going to position ourselves in buying, where we should focus more in terms of selling, bearing in mind where was the supply chain, in which routes were the supply chain least disruptive. So that meant obviously speaking to our shipping line partners, logistic partners, to understand what did they need. You know, some countries suffered more than the others, like the Far East. Everybody knows, you know, ships coming out of Far East to the US or to the UK. I don't know who were getting the containers. We certainly weren't. And long waits in getting any booking, and shipping lines were treating customers, even though we were most of their long-term customers, they were very precious about who they give the containers to. So we basically just kind of re-strategized in short term. Initially, it was the short term strategy. And then, of course, once you put short term in play, test it, you go long term. And we changed in terms of procurement, change of plan. Where do they need us? Sales.
So in terms of fighting against the high cross, the high ocean freight tariffs,
yes,
you find you're looking for suppliers more nearby to cut the freight costs?
Not particularly nearby. Sometimes it doesn't work like that. Believe it or not, it sometimes costs more to take a truck from Belgium to the UK than to send it all the way to India. Or, you know, to bring it from Italy to the UK again, to send all the way maybe perhaps to China or Singapore. It's all about supply demand, isn't it? And you know, we all know about shortage of truckers in the UK, shortage of truckers in America. We know all of these factors come into play. It was mainly about kind of working out where did these shipping lines needed us the most, who were the suppliers, where were they based, who needed us the most. And I think that kind of helped with our 19 years of experience in the trade. Had I been a startup in last 3 years, I don't think PG would have made through these difficult times. So I think, you know, it was a lot of kind of chopping and changing, learning along the way, but making sure that the business moved forward and we continuously spotting opportunities. Where do we need to be? Working with the, all our suppliers, kind of targeting their needs instead of our needs. That's what we changed.
But would you expect in the future that you will go into a more region-for-region strategy, that you produce and sell in one region and that you do the same in Asia or in North America, but less freight between the trade blocks? Would that be logical or is that impossible in your line of business?
Well, in my line of business and in my mind, nothing is impossible. So okay. I could always...
Good point.
Yeah, I can always look at... We are very actively... Everybody is talking about local. Like, you know, with everybody's questioning, is, does global work? Also in terms of, you, like John mentioned, sustainability and the impact of it, you know, all these delays and disruptions have had with the ships on that particular topic. Of course, you know, you move something only 10 miles, you're using less fuel. But then there is another set of challenges which come in, like skills. We've now, everybody wanted everything cheap. So everybody became so highly dependent upon China. Sometimes, again, it's not a question of, can I do everything local? Maybe not. But can I do something local to make sure that my supply chains in the future remain non-disruptive? What process can I do here? We are, at the moment, exploring a business, basically, again, in complete net zero sustainability piece, completely different from PG paper. And that's the part, you know, it's pieces of the puzzle that we are trying to work out. What do we do here? What do we need to take away? And then while doing the measurement of this carbon emissions, do we still come to negative or zero at the end? So it's all about working out for every different industry, every sector, every product, what works.
And it confirms also we did recently a survey among companies on whether they would go for that region for region strategy. And then what you hear a lot of companies saying, yeah, for some product lines or for critical parts, that's where we want to be sure.
Exactly.
But it's not that hundreds of manufacturing plants are knocking on the door of Europe and say, well, we want to set up new plants there. It's for parts of the business. Alfonso, you mentioned these disruptions with steel price, with 5G, with Brexit, and then I interrupted you because otherwise you kept on talking about all these disruptions. How is it changing your strategy? Is Cellnex doing... Can we expect that your company, in terms of where you operate, where you get your products from, where you set up your towers, will that change in the future?
Well, it's not that easy, because for the passive infrastructure, as you perfectly said, the number of potential meals where you can indirectly, because of course we buy via suppliers. When we have to install a new tower, our supply chain provides us with the tower. So it's not as easy as it could seem. In my view, what we are doing is we are trying to solve the problem counting on the supply chain. That means the supply chain needs to be protected. That means if you need to buy a number of towers you will need to install in advance, you cannot ask them to bear the financial load of acquiring and not being paid until this is installed. So anticipating payments, for example, to suppliers, this is happening in our company now.
But how much money are you prepared to pay additionally to make your supply chain more resilient? So you pay in advance your suppliers, you're pushing them hard, you allow them to pay a little bit higher prices.
And not only that.
Does that mean then that your product prices from all your suppliers go 15-20%?
Not only that, your suppliers are suffering the product, but are suffering the increase of fuel cost, are suffering the shortage of staff. So their costs are increasing.
But how much? Give us a figure, bandwidth.
Difficult to say. You are not free for giving them what you want because you also have contracts with customers. You have inflation, escalators, etc. So more than a figure.
It's certainly double-digit figure, right? That's fair to say.
Clearly. Yeah. I mean, if you want to comply, to be aligned with your commitments with customers, and this is very important because they have announced, depending on the country, they have obligations by the governments to have the 5G sites on air. You need to play with that. So maybe it's about reducing your profitability this first year, but making sure that you are solving the problem. Mm-hmm. And I will also say, we are engineers, we are not politicians, but I think some debate about these raw materials and the geostrategy about them needs to be reviewed. I mean, as it's happening now with the chipsets and the Huawei thing, et cetera, this is based on another thing. It's not about supply chain.
But the problem with the CHIPS Act, as well as in the US and in Europe, is that it takes so much time before, you know, if you have large companies like Intel announcing a large investment in Magdeburg in Germany, but before that plant is producing all its product, that takes time. So, John, my question, because semiconductors are important for your organization as well, what are you going to do in the meantime? Before all that production is more localized in Europe, for example, just paying higher prices, just waiting till the next shipments arrives?
No, I think one of the things. So there's clearly a danger here, right? Particularly if you're dependent on sources where the supply chain issues can happen. But as Poonam alluded to earlier, one of the things that Spire did early on, and this was just based on issues that we were having, was bringing insourcing essentially key components that we needed in our satellites. So we were getting all of our components essentially from China, and what was happening is we were having quality control issues. So it wasn't necessarily a supply chain issue, but we were having quality control issues. And if you have a quality control issue on a satellite, there's kind of no turning back. If you launch something into space, even though if it passes tests and it's not right, you know, you've just wasted all that money. So we brought that in-house in Glasgow, which was a big reason why we came to Scotland, was because we could get the expertise around these different components in Glasgow. So I think it's about how do you mitigate that risk? How do you identify, and it's hard to do, but how do you identify the long-term ROI of maybe bringing some things that are more expensive to bring them in-house, but you are mitigating that risk of potentially suffering from those components not being available or relying on, you know, for instance, everything manufactured in one particular part of the world.
But does that mean that the prices of your products and getting the satellites up and running, that has gone up in the last 2 years with 20-25% or so, something like that?
Well, the cost of building, manufacturing, and launching a small satellite is basically in the throes of Moore's Law right now. So if you go back 5-6 years ago, the cost of doing that was just under $1 million. Now we can do that under $200,000.
Okay.
So there might be certain components that are going up, but when you look at, for us, the biggest cost of our delivery is getting a satellite into space. And we don't own the launch service component. That's the one thing that Spire does not own. We own everything else but the launch service. And there's so many now commercial launch services in productization that are out there in market that we now have options, and that's what's been driving the price down. So we can afford to bring some of that production in-house because the industry, by and large, is starting to find cost efficiencies.
Alfonso mentioned that Brexit was not his favorite decision of the British government, right, or the British people, more or less. What do you see in your day-to-day practice on how companies reacted the last couple of years, or perhaps even the next years, in answering the Brexit challenges? Because from a product supply point of view, life has not become easier for a lot of in UK producing company. What is your take on that?
Well, yeah, I would say in general, even a bit broader than Brexit, is I think companies increasingly take a very complete picture in terms of their operations and what these changes would mean. Basically meaning that when they evaluate locations, they look at a very full picture of operating costs, for instance, not only labor, utilities, but of course also duties.
But what saw you happening as Brexit happened? So for some companies that was good, for other companies that was worse. What have you seen happening with the competitiveness of the UK to attract companies as response to Brexit?
Well, what of course I think a key disadvantage is, of course, I think that the UK was always seen as a gateway to the rest of Europe, and that is certainly something that will have been impacted by Brexit. And we have also seen that many companies that have location in UK, not necessarily left UK, but at least had to set up something in Europe on the continent then to continue their operations. And that is a logical consequence of that. I think...
Poonam, you recognize that because you are active in the British India business communities?
I absolutely agree. I have personally...
That was not the intention of my question. My intention is that the panelists disagree, but okay.
But I can't disagree when what goes
yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
I'll find this point of disagreement somewhere. So there are so many British companies that I know have actually, despite their best efforts, ceased operations in Europe. And I mean, I, I'm the vice president of Scottish Chamber of Commerce. Plus, I guess with my international experience, I do mentor quite a few companies. They just come in asking, and if I have time, I'll always answer a random question. And there are a lot of companies who've simply, I ask them, like, why would you cease doing business in Europe? Because of Brexit. And the other way around as well. It's not just the British companies seizing businesses in Europe. It's also the other way around. My company, we buy paper. You know, a lot of paper comes from Scandinavia. A lot of handling happens in Antwerp, Rotterdam, Germany, all of these places. A lot of paper mills are in Germany as well. Even though we could operate, or there are certain special licenses being given out, my team would often say to me that there is certain bias unless we use a local company in Germany. So you've got to work around the system a lot. Now, for some people, there is value in working around that system, but maybe perhaps for smaller businesses, if they wanted to expand in Europe before, they've kind of seized that ambition because that 10% that they had there, they're struggling to hold on to. I don't know, like a lot of people say to me, there is that bias. You know, the Europeans feel we would like to use European product. We don't want to buy from British companies and other way around. I've not faced that in my own business at all. But when my team will tell me, oh, certain cargo is stuck in Germany because the customs wants to inspect it. And I'd be like, why? It's just paper. And it was moving very, you can see that there is something not fitting in there anymore. And we are ourselves forced now to go and put a company in Belgium. We are actually in process of having an office in Belgium simply so we have a foot in Europe. And again, Kuhn was right that Britain used to be a place where a lot of companies will come and set up and then look for markets in Europe. Whereas this has completely changed now. This is more becoming Belgium, Amsterdam, I'm hearing a lot. I would say between these two. So I guess we are paying somewhere the penance of voting not to be in Europe in terms of business. And of course, then there has to be an effect of inflation with duties and everything coming into picture.
A topic which also plays an important role in the way how companies set up their manufacturing and distribution operations is the labor market, the availability, the skill set, the cost of people. And we will have tomorrow a specific session here at the forum on that. And yesterday there was a training where that was also a hot topic. Alfonso, if you talk about the labor availability within your company, how much of a headache is that? Because you could say, yeah, you know, HR always complains about finding the right people. Is that problem becoming more severe than ever before, or is it just you have to deal with it, that's it?
In my view, it's an important problem now for the UK-based companies. In fact, there's a high rotation, churn. We are losing talent every week inside our sector because other companies are lacking as well talent. So this is good for the employees, in theory, but it's creating an inflation in terms of paying more salaries. If you combine that with difficulties to export to Europe, for example, I think the combination is awful for the UK-based companies.
But if you compare that, for example, with the labor market in Spain, let's say,
well, it's probably
is that completely different, or is that more advantageous?
It's completely different. In Spain, we have a big rate of unemployment, so rotation is not happening very often. You don't change company many times. It's completely different here. It's much more dynamic. I would compare probably the UK market with Germany or France. And I think that this effect of warming up the salaries and increasing the cost for the company is not happening in France and Germany. I think it's mostly based or motivated by Brexit. So this is something I think...
We see actually in our practice that labor market shortages and higher labor costs, we see it also in Central and Eastern Europe. It's not only the UK. Just
very quick example. I'm also a member of the Spanish Chamber of Commerce in the UK. And engineering companies in Spain, building underground toll roads, railway, are very good, are very cost competitive, so they won. They are still winning lots of projects here in the UK. They used to mix staff, so local staff and some engineers coming from Spain. This was cheaper in the past, so it allowed them to compete in the public tenders. And that was a value for the country because the infrastructure was built at a lower cost. Mm-hmm. This is now changing because the cost for them to repatriate talent is much higher. The visa cost depends on the salary of the person coming to the country. So they are now going to the market. Again, in theory, good for the employees, good for the workers. Problem, they are not prepared. You don't have a number of skilled people waiting for you of the self to start and...
But why are you saying for the employees it's good in theory? It's not only good in theory, it's just on your bank account it's better.
If I'm an electronic engineer or telecom engineer and I can move from this company to that company and every time I jump my salary increases £3,000, in theory I'm happy. In the end it will be bad also for the employees because the cost for the companies is increasing and they will be less competitive, that's my opinion. But I mean, in a first look, it's good for the employees, and we are living that. We are losing people every week. Also, with the combination of the after COVID and people wanting to commute less and to work from home more days, another story.
But you could also say, Alfonso, we know that we have in many European countries and I believe 45 of the 50 US states, we have labor shortages. We also know they will not disappear because the aging of the population in Europe. So if you want to be the employer of choice, you just have to offer your employees a better offering, which can be salary or fringe benefits or secondary benefits or career developments. You just have to spend more money.
Well, there's a limit for that as well, because you have contracts and you have in public, in practice, if you're public listed, you are also very controlled in the way that you manage your company. No? So, I mean, it shouldn't be acceptable for the market that you decide to increase your salaries to everyone every year just for not losing talent. You can do your best, but it's not a solution.
No? John, how do you look at that when you set up your operations here in Scotland with that insourcing element you mentioned before? How is the labor market here for you? And can you compare it with other regions in Europe where you operate or in the world?
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty sensitive topic in the sense that we're struggling mightily with hiring. I think we have something like 75...
It's not a sensitive topic. Why is it sensitive? Because it's happening to everybody.
It's happening to everyone. I mean, everyone's trying to figure it out, and it's actually a real pain point for pretty much every company out there. You know, for instance, go back to a sense of loyalty. You know, in San Francisco, I've pretty much stopped hiring in San Francisco because there's no sense of loyalty there. You'll hire somebody, and 12 months later, they will jump for the highest salary. But when you look at the vast majority of our offices, so we have, you know, three offices in the U.S., but our biggest offices are in Glasgow and Luxembourg, and now Toronto, Ontario. But when you look at what our employees really want, they say two things. One, they want to have a sense of purpose, a sense of mission in what they're doing, right? And the second is they want to have a sense of belonging. They want to feel like they're really a part of something, that they have a connection with their teams, with the people that they work with. We typically don't see, outside of Silicon Valley, an emphasis on compensation or an emphasis on equity, particularly in Europe, where, you know, a negotiation with a European employee might be a little bit on the salary, not at all on equity, whereas you go to the West Coast of the U.S., it's all on equity and nothing on salary, right? So there's a bit of a difference there. But we're seeing less about wanting more money and more about, is this for me? Am I going to feel good about this? Am I going to have a connection?
Do you see a contradiction in that sense of belonging and, on the other hand, the wish of a lot of, particularly young employees, to stay as much as possible working from home? How does those two interfere?
We're trying to solve that. What kind of methods do you use with that?
More parties?
Well, I tell you what, demanding that employees come in 3 days a week didn't quite work out as like we thought it would. So we came out, I believe, in April, just like every technology company, and said, hey, we want employees in, you know, 3 days out of every week. And that was met with a lot of resistance. And so we've had to ease into that. What we've been trying to do is really, you know, emphasizing the
fact... You mean by resistance that people wanted to stay 4 weeks at home? Is that what you... 4 days?
They didn't want to come into the office.
Yeah. Or at all, yeah, okay.
They didn't want to come into the office. And I think it's almost, is it the Stockholm syndrome where, you know, you feel like you're so abused that you can't change things up? I think employees have been home for so long, right, without interaction with other people, and they want that interaction, but that means they have to change. And that change is actually going back into the office. And I think something's going on mentally and psychologically with folks who are, you know, really craving that interaction with people, but they can't get themselves to actually engage again. And so we're trying to figure that. We haven't solved it. We're trying to figure
it out. How do you look at that, Poonam? That Stockholm syndrome, that this is the completely new explanation of the Stockholm syndrome we get here. How do you see that? Let's say, on the one hand, the sense of belonging, on the other hand, the wish of many employees to work at home, and you still want to build a team, and you're particularly strong in that. How do you see that?
Well, some learnings came during COVID. It was obvious that some people, they were extremely productive. But now, I also acknowledge here, not every industry can operate with people working from home. I mean, imagine a hotel. It can't have people working from home. I'll change your bed virtually. doesn't work. So it was quite a learning during COVID where we saw certain people excelled working from home. They were way more productive. And, you know, we kept very close watch, managerial level and, you know, vertically as well. Mental health has been a big issue during COVID and been talked about. How is, and we are still grateful we can do it, because across all our business, we only have about 200 odd employees, so it's still manageable on personal level as well at within layers. And so the ones who were productive from home, even when we are asking people to come back, they would come back, and they might still have some inhibitions that, you know, like, we'll get COVID, our family get COVID, work is important for me, why do I have to come in the office? I do so well working from home. I think it's that driving piece. I will drive from 45 minutes from Glasgow to Greenock, which is our headquarters, and I'll drive back. I get so much more done. There is a little bit element of quality of life there that, you know, when I need a break, yeah, you can walk out of our office as well, which we really highly tell our employees to do. But then, you know, they're like, okay, in our own time, nobody's judging us, nobody's seeing where we are going, but we get the work done. So I guess it's working. What we have done is looked at our productive team, who did very well, were working on their own, I guess, drive during COVID period, and actually were even more productive to come once a week. And they're very happy with that. Most of them are really happy with that. But there are certain ones who absolutely say, we cannot function working from home. And those are the people that we have been able to make space for with social distancing, which we are still maintaining despite ease of everything. Then we have global team. And we've actually applied the same principle in our office in India, in our other offices, and that same thing is working everywhere. We used to have about 35 people work in our office in Delhi. And when the COVID hit, you know, and they come from all over India, regional, small villages. Why do they come to Delhi? Because they need jobs. But, you know, their cost of living is one third if they were to go back to their village. And a lot of them are extremely productive, and they enjoy working from home. They have better quality life again. Delhi, everybody knows currently, is the most polluted city in the world. We scattered our team. It was a tough, you know, it was a working, learning experience over a few months, I'd say, keeping talking and all that. And when, again, the same thing happened, we at the moment only have about 12 people who report in our office in Delhi, and those are the people who say we need to work together. We are more productive because we can bounce off ideas off each other. I think that's what we have managed to do. And obviously, for that, you know, our business model helps as well. The technology we have in the business helps as well. But I know that cannot apply to all businesses.
And would you say that in the location studies you do, say, for example, for a manufacturing plant, and you look into your career so far, would you say that the element of labor availability, skill set, labor cost perhaps, that has become a more important factor if you compare it with all the other location factors which play a role?
More important, I would say it's a crucial factor. But although I have to say immediately, it's crucial, when certainly when we're talking about services there, it's by far
in the services, it's
but in manufacturing, there are, of course, a lot of other factors that also come into play. Like infrastructure and access to energy, access to supplies, etc. But access to skills is indeed one of the main elements. And then indeed, increasingly, competition is, of course, one of the key differentiators. Because, of course, there are regions around the world where unemployment is virtually zero, so then it becomes very difficult to invest there. And actually, that's where I want to get into as well. I think you have to be think very carefully of what you do where, of course. Maybe there is also some of hotspot type of issue playing out here. Alfonso said, indeed, in Spain it's different. Well, maybe you should start looking at Spain then, just as an example, and not only look at the hotspots.
So what you're saying is keep away from the hotspots.
Well, there are many hotspots now, so it's not that easy, of course. But at least you should look carefully. Maybe there are things you can split in terms of activities or in terms of skills you need or types of activities that you do. And you have to think carefully of what you do where, I think, to respond to that problem, which is indeed widespread, of course.
Okay. Let me take a look into the room. Is there anybody who would like to pose a question to one of the panelists or the whole panel? The mic will come to you. Yeah, there is a question here on the front.
I mean, I think one thing that I was looking for, which I would like to hear a bit more about, is the benefit from onshoring and nearshoring. Do you know of any kind of quantitative analysis that's been done on the benefits? Because I think we mentioned when you nearshore, especially if it's to a developed economy, you're going to experience an escalation of costs. Right.
Okay, let's ask the question first to the consultant, right?
Right.
Dear consultant, the question is, let's say, when companies are looking into reorganize their supply chain, what are the advantages companies have if they onshore or nearshore, at least, let's say, are not dependent anymore from supplies or raw materials far away? What are the main advantages you see?
That's a very complex question, actually, to answer.
No, it's a simple question, right? It's a simple question. Yeah.
No, but
she's nodding yes. It's a simple question.
What I want to say is it's always sector-specific. You have to basically do the analysis and see, indeed, in the balance, what does make sense. It's basically product-specific. Mm-hmm. Because you have to take into account, from a cost perspective, you have to take into account all the components that are into play, from labor, utilities, transportation, duties, of course, and that's product specific. So it's very difficult to say upfront, okay, without doing the analysis, this is how it will look like, and whether we should nearshore, onshore, offshore.
But if companies to choose that, then it's probably to have a more resilient supply chain and not be dependent on suppliers far away or not being dependent on skyrocketing freight rates. Something that those are probably the arguments you also see in your practice that companies are exploring once they decide or want to review their footprint.
Well, and indeed, so it's the cost is of course one thing, but what is of course there's always this balance with what you could call the quality of operations, the risk that your operations are running, and that is true that indeed, of course, in recent years the resilience argument has become much more important. But it's not always easy to translate that into a cost or a profit element. It's also a qualitative element, a strategic element. How important is it for you? Are your customers willing to pay for it? So it's always this balance between these two elements. So that's another reason why it's difficult to say upfront, okay, this will be the outcome. And a third reason is opportunities in terms of location options. I mentioned before, like for instance, US, there is a great nearshore option, namely Mexico. It's a very competitive location. In Europe, you could say, I mentioned also before, Northern Africa has great potential, but also great challenges.
But don't you see Central and Eastern Europe or
of
some
course.
Countries
yes.
in Central and Eastern Europe as interesting nearshore alternatives?
Just to build on that question, I guess I always hear, and I think, Renee, you referred to it, that there is this trend towards reshoring and nearshoring, but I actually haven't seen any data, I haven't seen any analysis, I haven't seen any number other than this is a trend that's coming, whether it's because of supply chain issues or whether it's because of ESG issues. We don't want to source from these countries far away that have, you know, crazy labor practices. So I'm just curious whether there's been anything done that is actually convincing enough that, yeah, maybe we should really, as a corporate, mm-hmm. consider this seriously because of X, Y, and Z data points that are coming out.
But I agree with what Koen is saying. It's depending on sector of industry. But we have actually worked the last 2-3 years for a number of companies who actually had originally plans to expand, for example, in Malaysia, and then set up the Malaysia plant for Europe, and now are setting up this plant in Europe, let's say, to serve the European market. So I think what you could say, it has, there is a lot of talk about that, about reshoring and decentralization of production. At least our experiences from our teams around the world is that that is now C-level agenda. It's not anymore, and that is due to the row of disruptions, because it's not only COVID, it was also these freight rates, it's also about costs, about other disruptions. The question is, can European regions and cities, can you have to supply a couple of things. One is you have to supply, you have to provide the labor market, and the second, what you have to provide is also the supplier ecosystem. And that's for a lot of companies a problem, because it's not only about bringing a product from Asia to Europe, it's also, can you then really de-risk your supply chain also with components and sub-assemblies? And I think that's also where a lot of, and perhaps I can use, I see here, time is up. You know, I have here a screen, time is up, in now in black, but then they warned me it will be in red. But one of the things, if I may use that as a kind of conclusion, I think that the, if you talk about a company producing vaccines, I gave that example yesterday, you need 289 components to make a vaccine. You can say, okay, well, then I set up a new plant in the US or Europe, and then you can de-risk part of that supply chain, but still there will be coming products and sub-assemblies or equipment you use will come from other parts of the world. Actually, I think that for organizations like here present in the room, there is an interesting opportunity to help companies to identify local suppliers, local being European suppliers, because it's one of the main hurdles of companies actually for executing an onshore or nearshore option. It has to do obviously with cost and with labor, but it has also to do with the right suppliers. And identifying them, which could also be a great boost for the small and medium-sized enterprises in your company, could be a win-win strategy. You win foreign investors and you boost the business of your of the companies already in your region or state or country. And with that, we get now closing remarks. So let me first ask a round of applause for our great panel here this afternoon.
Thank you, Renee. Thank you to the panelists. We are going to meet again at 6 o'clock in the Sheraton lobby. You do not want to miss the gala, and I promise I don't think you're going to want to walk over there. Anybody that was on the exciting bus tour last night, I don't think we're going to have a repeat. Robert, I think we're good. All right? That's it, folks. We'll see you in a little bit.